Right, thank you very much. I want to talk about two very different kinds of dynamical systems, one of which I think has been unbelievably ignored. And I'll get straight on to that. Let's hope that works there. It's beautifully illustrated by Janus, the Roman god that looks in two ways at once. Let me just, first of all, say there's going to be a point exactly in the middle of those heads, which we call the Janus point. And I want you to see that those two faces look very similar, but they're not exactly the same, right? So that's the key thing. Right, now, so, and I'm going to talk about what I call Janus point solutions. And the simplest one is the simplest thing we can possibly have, Newton's first law of motion, endpoint particles moving inertially. Now, just look at this. They move inertially. There is always one point where the center of mass moment of inertia is at its minimal value. The size is minimal. And in both time directions, it expands outwards. Now, you shouldn't really have arrows on this depicting the velocities because of time reversal symmetry, which is a key feature, you could put the arrows where you like. But whatever way you put it, in both of these limits, you have Hubble-type expansion, which is extremely special. That's an attractor of pure inertial motion, Hubble-type expansion at both ends. And as you go out, you're actually, at this point here, at the Janus point, you can specify positions and momenta arbitrarily. And at this point, the configuration of the system, its behavior, is most at its most typical. But as you go out here, the Hubble-type expansion is an attractor, and you get into highly atypical behavior. Now, in the second law of thermodynamics, we think that...
Can you say what you mean by Hubble-type expansion? Because I'm not sure I know what you mean.
That the particles are all moving apart. In the asymptotic limit, the distance between all of the particles increases linearly with the time. That's Hubble expansion. Okay. Hubble's law.
But it's Hubble expansion in an empty
universe. In an empty universe. But the key thing about Hubble expansion is the recession velocity is proportional to the distance.
Okay.
And in the second law of thermodynamics, we like to think that as time passes, the universe goes from being in an untypical special state into a more disordered state. But in fact, the absolute simplest dynamical model you can have, it goes in the opposite way. So I think this is cause for thought. I'm coming to my second type of thing. Okay.
You do depend on the box. You're just ignoring the box when you make this thing.
Well, the question is this. This is what the debate is going to be about, Neil. Is the universe in a box? And frankly, my reaction is to tell that one to the Marines. But let's go on. I'm going to be provoked.
Your model is in a box.
It is not in a box. It's in a Euclidean space.
Oh, okay.
There's no box. I beg your pardon. Yes, that's just the...
There's a box.
That's a
oh, sorry. Good point. Thank you. My apologies. My humble apologies.
It's outside the box.
Without the boxes, yes. Okay.
But wait a second. You're imagining there's no box.
Imagining there's no box.
Then the system's ill-defined.
It's perfectly well-defined. We will come to that, Neil.
I don't think it's well-defined. I mean, how are you going to specify the initial state? Where's it all going?
You
have to show that the results do not depend on how you define the system in a finite way.
This is the key thing that's coming. Niels, I don't know whether that was picked up, but the critique was fair at this level. Okay. We need gravity to answer your worries, Neil.
Okay.
And we will. So that's that one. So now we do put it in a box, and suddenly we get the second type of motion, which is Poincaré recurrences. So at some point, we suddenly put that box there. The free inertial motion is now forced to equilibrate. And you get into the situation with Poincaré recurrences. This is a totally different situation which has been created by that box. And you may remember about 1900, Boltzmann wrote a remarkable letter to Nature, or had a paper in Nature, where he was saying the only way that I can think about, well, it wasn't even Boltzmann, it was his assistant, the only way I can think of explaining the second law of thermodynamics is that we happen to be living just after a huge fluctuation of the entropy. If there are any intelligent beings around, they've got to live close to that point. So these ones here will say that is their past, and these ones here will say that is their past. So time will go in opposite directions for them, and they will be condemned to a heat death up there. And that is what you get in Poincaré recurrence type systems. You get totally different behavior if you don't put that box there. So let's go on to the next one. I'm now going to show you what the typical Newtonian three-body problem with zero energy and zero angular momentum looks like. Every single solution of this thing, except for a set of measures, zero we can ignore, that has been known for 100 years. What it does, it's called elliptic hyperbolic escape. So you have a single particle moving inertially in the asymptotic limit, coming towards a Kepler pair, which is coming from the other side. There is a process of non-trivial three-body interaction. There may be a change of partners, and a new Kepler pair goes off in this direction, and the single particle goes off there. Again, that box is there purely just because that's how we had to put it on, or the way Flavio drew it on there. Let me say that this is the Janus point in there. This is a Janus point type of solution. Every single one is that thing. Now, Neil, at this stage, because we've got the Kepler pair formed, it effectively becomes a rod and a clock. It has a semi-major axis, and it has a period. And with respect to that clock in the Kepler pair, you can establish, if you've got the data, you can establish that this thing is moving inertially and in a straight line. Question, yeah?
Doesn't this depend on your choice of cutoff?
Sorry?
Doesn't this depend on your choice of cutoff? Like, otherwise, don't these masses...
There is absolutely no cutoff. Just goes on forever.
No, so when the masses are... If there's no angular momentum, when they just...
If there's no angular momentum, what's the issue?
Depending on your initial condition, you could just have the masses all colliding at a single point.
That's measure zero.
Okay.
Oh, that's yes. There are measure zero situations, but we're assuming that there is motion, and every single solution is of this nature, except for a very exceptional set.
Right, but you're taking a problem that's governed by time reversal.
Beg your pardon?
You're choosing a problem that is governed by equations that have time reversal. The moment you include allow for any dissipation in the problem, it's not going to repeat.
If we have time, I'm going to show you how what looks like dissipation comes into this out of dynamical necessity. It's a pure, our conjecture, attack it, I mean, we want severe criticism. Our conjecture is that the second law of thermodynamics is a dynamical necessity. It is a direct consequence of a particular type of the law of the universe, and it occurs, we think we can show securely that it occurs in the Newtonian n-body problem with that condition up there, and that is a pretty good model of a toy model of the universe. So that's the aim. So may I go on? Now I just want to introduce you to some key concepts. So one of them is the root mean square length, which is defined here. These are the separations between the particles. Those are their masses. You add up all pairs, and that gives you the root mean square length. It's a democratically mass-weighted quantity. That's one key length. And another one is the mean harmonic length, which is here, and that is essentially the Newton potential. Now, I want something, and this deals with Paul's question, about observables. I want something which is a scale-invariant quantity which is going to characterize the extent to which my collection of particles is either clustered or very uniform. It wants to be scale-invariant. It's got to be a ratio of two lengths, mass-weighted, to be democratic. And the two simplest ones you can take are precisely those. And we call this the complexity here. And it is a very sensitive measure of clustering. We have a very good idea when we see particles getting closer together or further apart, or when it's very uniform. So it's a very sensitive measure of that. And there's also a very remarkable thing, is that if you take the negative of it, it's what's called, in the n-body theory, it's called either the normalized Newton potential or the shape potential. Because if you think that only shapes count and relative separations count, then you want a potential governing the universe in which only changes only the shapes and not the size, because size is a gauge degree of freedom. And precisely multiplying Newton potential by the square root of the moment of inertia takes out those forces that change the size of the system. So rather remarkably, this simplest sort of thing that you could choose to measure the complexity of the system is also the one that is driving the shape dynamics, how the system is really changing. So the objective behavior of the system, all you can see, is governed by that quantity. That's the potential that governs it. And we can never observe anything other than ratios. When we say the universe is expansion, the evidence comes from comparison of wavelengths. It does not, we do not see the universe expanding. So now our key concept is shape space. We want to go from the Newtonian configuration, we quotient it with respect to the similarity group, and we get shape space. So this is the space of possible shapes. And in the next diagram, we see it for the three-body case. Now, for 25 years, I've been saying that quantum gravity will be discovered through trying to quantize the Newtonian three-body problem. I still remain fairly hopeful that will be possible. Heisenberg found quantum mechanics by quantizing the harmonic oscillator. We need to have a non-trivial dynamical model. The first really serious non-trivial dynamical model in physics is the three-body problem. And that's where we need to think about things. So now there are, if you, the shape dynamical description, so altogether there are 6n minus 12 degrees of freedom when you take out positions and orientations. And two of these are what are called the dilatational moment. That is actually, it's the time derivative of the center of mass moment of inertia, essentially. It's this quantity here, and it has, this is a conjugate pair, the center of mass moment of inertia and the dilatational momentum. And what remains are 6n minus 14 shape degrees of freedom. These are scale invariant. And it's a very striking fact that you have all these shape degrees of freedom and just this one canonical pair. What is that doing? It sticks out like a sore thumb. So now the joy about this in the three-body problem, you have a beautiful picture of it. This is called the shape sphere, introduced by Richard Montgomery at Santa Cruz. So two angles determine the shape of a triangle. So you can plot the possible shapes of a three-body universe, the shapes of the triangles, on the surface of a sphere, the equilateral, and if this is for equal masses because you take into account the masses. For the equal mass case, the equilateral triangles are at the poles. So here is the equator. So a point here with there and opposite latitudes, those are mirror images of each other. The equator is the collinear configurations. Here are what are called, there are three Euler configurations where one particle is in between the other two, and this complexity function, which we've plotted here with contour lines, there's an extremum of it there. It's a saddle point. At the equilateral triangle, that complexity is at its minimum, its absolute minimum. And that's a result, that actually holds for any mass, and that's a result that Lagrange discovered in 1772. So that's it there. Then you have what we call the two-body collisions. It's really where two particles get very close to each other, and the other one is much further away. So the shape potential or the complexity gets an infinitely large value because of that fact. It's not because the Newton potential has gone infinite because two particles are very close. It's because of that ratio, everything in terms of ratios. So now we have here plotted the various contour lines of this complexity. Actually, Paul, that complexity is actually a shape observable. It's a shape observable. It's scale invariant. So let me go on to the next.
Can I make an observation? answer to you, there's no need for any cutoff because a collision, a central collision, can only happen in one of these four configurations, the collinear configurations that are Euler and equilateral triangles. They're called central configurations. And you can see that if you plot the possible solutions, only a set of measure zero will go through that point at the center.
Yeah, Dr. Smolin pointed that.
Yeah.
Right. Now there comes a little bit of mathematics, I mean, real equations. Now, key to this is the Lagrange-Jacobi relation. Lagrange found it in a very famous paper of 1772 on the three-body problem. Jacobi generalized it to the n-body problem. If you have a potential which is homogeneous of some degree k, so this is the definition of a homogeneous function, a homogeneous potential, you multiply all the arguments by a constant, and then you get the potential back again, but multiplied by that constant to some power k. And that k is the degree of homogeneity. And the Newton potential is homogeneous of degree minus one. And that is absolutely crucial. And I think it looks as if there's the same sort of thing is going to happen in general relativity as well. So then you get this relation. This is the Lagrange-Jacobi relation. For any k, it is also called the virial relation because it leads to virial theorems. So it says that the second time derivative of the moment of inertia is equal to the center of mass energy minus this thing here, and V is the potential. This is for whatever homogeneity degree the potential has, that is your expression. Now, if the energy is non-negative, zero or positive, and we especially like the case where it's zero, the Newton potential is negative, definite. We have k is equal to minus 1. You put that in there, and you find that the second derivative of the moment of inertia is positive. This is the first qualitative result discovered in dynamics by Lagrange. It showed that the Newtonian n-body problem with non-negative energy is unstable. At least one particle must escape to infinity. It led to all the business with whether the solar system, which has negative energy, is stable. The king of Sweden giving the prize, Poincaré getting it and discovering chaos. So this was, you know, a really major part of history. And what is really significant as well, so the moment of inertia is U-shaped upwards, and it goes through a unique minimum where it's flat. That is where the dilatational momentum is exactly zero. But otherwise, the dilatational momentum on one side starts at minus infinity. It comes down, it passes through zero just once, goes up to plus infinity. It's a Lyapunov variable. It's always positive and growing. This immediately shows that the Newtonian n-body problem cannot be ergodic. It cannot have Poincaré recurrences. That's an absolute fact. And it's just amazing to me how many people who talk about the entropy of the universe, without seeming to know about anything about this, seem to think it is in a box and is subject to Poincaré recurrences. So I just throw that out as think about it. So now the next thing is you have dynamical similarity. It relies on the same thing. If you have that case with the homogeneity, if you scale all of the quantities in that way and you scale the time in that way, it maps solutions to solutions, which are geometrically identical. And if for k equals the minus 1 of what we're talking about here, that gives you Kepler's third law. That's where Kepler's third law comes. But what this means is that there's a whole one-parameter family of solutions in the Newtonian theory that if you map it to shape space, becomes invisible. You cannot see it. And this is interesting because the talk on Noether's theorem, the technical one by Peter Olver, he was talking about it. This is a symmetry which is not subject to the wonderful results of the Noether theorem. There aren't conserved quantities associated.
It's a classical symmetry. It changes the action by a scale.
It changes the action by a scale because you multiply it. Thank you for the clarification. So that's very, very important. Now, I'm going to tell you now something about change of scale is manifested as attractor behavior on S. Let me see if I can go on to the next one. Yes, here we are. Now, in the shape dynamics description, you can show on, if you go to shape space and you take its cotangent bundle, that gives you a phase space, and you can findally a Hamiltonian description of it. This thing, the logarithm of it in that representation acts on the potential, but you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, and you, on shape space, you get something which looks like dissipation, or really it's an attractor, and this means that this complexity we're talking about grows, admittedly, with fluctuations, but it grows secularly. Let me go on to the next one. So let me show you again what happens. Here's that typical three-body solution I showed you. This is plotted its behavior as it goes around on the shape sphere. And here is that magic point, the Janus point here, where the solution goes off in one direction or the other direction. So going this way, these are the two faces of the Janus image. They are of the same broad nature, but in detail they are different. So one half goes round, it goes round, it comes out there, and of necessity it has to tumble down this potential well of the shape potential, and the other one goes round and it does exactly the same. So now if you were to start a whole lot of systems at the analogous point, so we have a Gibbs ensemble of these solutions which go here, they could be spread out over as large an area as you like, you let them go, and they will all fall down these wells. So you have an attractor on shape space. And that is, I think, very, very significant. So here's another way of looking at it. Here again is the solution there that I show you. What we've plotted here, this is Flavio's diagrams. He does them all for me. Thank you, Flavio. What we have plotted here, first of all, there are two things that you cannot directly observe. You deduce them from what you can observe. What you cannot, this is what you, if you could see in the extended phase space, you would see how the moment of inertia, this is an actual solution that Flavio calculated, you would see the moment of inertia with this beautiful U-shaped curve and the flat point there. This is its time derivative, the dilatational momentum. It goes through zero once, it's monotonic, you see it there. But then what is happening is this is the complexity plotted. On both sides, as the Kepler, these fluctuations are due to the formation of the Kepler pair. It's got eccentricity, so it goes backwards and forwards while the third particle is going away. But you see beautifully here, this Janus picture, where on one side the fluctuations are rather bigger, but it's qualitatively the same on the two sides. So it's very, very nice. And now, intuitively, you would think if I had 1,000 bodies, those fluctuations would cancel out. This is a 1,000-body simulation, which somebody called Jerome Barclay kindly did for us. I can't be absolutely sure about its accuracy, these calculations, I think, but it's certainly broadly right. And you see this there. So there's the Janus point there. Now, this morning, while I was looking through my slides, I thought of what we could do, but Flavio didn't have the time to produce it in the time, but we will do it the next time we talk about it. This is Flavio's artistic representation, but this is really in the extended phase space. This is at the Janus point. The system is at its most uniform, like a swarm of bees. And as it goes out, things form, clusters, Kepler pairs form. Now, what would be really nice, how many of you here have seen the Millennium simulation of the formation of structure in the universe? I guess quite a number of you have. I was at Yale about 3 years ago when Martin Rees gave a talk, and he said, I'm now going to show you how structure forms in the universe, but I'm going to cheat, because if I showed you the universe expanding, it would soon go out of the story. So you saw the structure forming. And afterwards, I went up to Martin and I said, actually, you weren't cheating and deceiving people by doing that. You were actually showing the truth, because that is actually all you can observe. So what we want to do actually is have a comparison of this, where actually this picture at the Janus point, all of these points would be distributed uniformly over there. Here we can put in a box now, Neil, because the shape space has a compact measure. It has a finite measure. We've managed to, by taking out scale, we create, the universe has its own box once you take its scale out. And so what one would really see is here a completely uniform distribution, and here all these Kepler pairs and other clusters forming. Now, did I, let me see, no, it's, I need to go back one. Yes, so we have there the creation of complexity and information. Now, this thing about information, this is a notion which Tim Koslovsky put into our collaboration, the three of us, Flavia, myself, and Tim, who sadly can't be here. Tim pointed out that as these Kepler pairs form and get ever better stabilized, their orbital elements get ever better defined. So people observing these things would see the orbital elements settling down to ever more digital places. So this is a conservation and a recording of information. And in fact, that information which is put in at the initial data or the midpoint data at the Janus point gets expressed in the orbital elements of the Kepler pair and the direction and speed at which that other particle is escaping. So it is creation, it is transformation of information which is in the data at the midpoint into more explicit form. It's transforming. It's making the information more explicit and more precise.
Sorry, what do you mean by that? You have an equation, a system of equations completely deterministic.
So yes.
You have an infinitely powerful computer or ability to calculate. You know every single parameter to arbitrary precision. So what do you mean that you get better and better at determining the parameter?
You can see it with your eyes.
I don't know what that means.
You can't, if I showed you that, you wouldn't dream that a little bit later all these beautiful Kepler pairs would be there. These Kepler pairs also, moreover, remain mutually congruent, and they separate in Hubble type expansion. This is the asymptotic limit of the n-body problem. It breaks up into clusters. Whenever there are Kepler pairs, they asymptotically they make ever better rods and clocks, and they are also signposts. They fix direction in absolute space, and you actually see what is hidden. It is the unwinding of the information in the thing. Time unfolds what is hidden at this stage into this beautiful picture we see whenever we walk around, including us here, perhaps.
Can I make it? Maybe,
yeah, Flavia.
It's just talking about the fact that the linear momentum and the angular momentum and the energy of each cluster are conserved only asymptotically. They're not conserved, they fluctuate because of the influence of the rest of the system, but as the universe the universe expands, they will asymptotically go to
quantum. Oh, sure.
Actually,
that's fine,
quantum.
But it's not just that getting more information. I mean, the information, no. I always knew all the information I wanted to, if I could. I mean, if I cared to actually do the calculation to arbitrarily high precision, I can always do that.
Yes, but actually it makes it easier for you to do calculations over a short time, because once it's got into the asymptotic regime, it's much easier to pick up the salient features. So if you're out there, it's very difficult to predict things immediately there. You have to have very precise things. When it's broken up into clusters here, you can do a pretty good approximation quite a long way back and forward as well, because you now, with measurements to a given accuracy, you can predict in both time directions much, much more readily.
Let me give it a try. Of course, if you have a pure state, just like in quantum mechanics, if you have the precise specifications of the point in the phase space, you don't gain a better understanding of which point you are in the phase space. Information is preserved. It's a deterministic system. But measures of complexity and entropy and information and so forth always require a coarse graining, which always requires a choice of observables. So what you can say, I believe, is that here's a choice of observables. Which particles end up paired with who in the Kepler pair? So you start with the big mass. Everybody is bound to everybody else. It would be very difficult to do a system to pull out those observables from the initial configuration. But if you wait long enough, you can easily see and classify
sure.
the particles into Kepler pairs. And so if that's your coarse graining that you choose, then there is an increase of information as the system evolves and more Kepler pairs resolve.
Right, but that's a very particular choice of coarse graining. I mean, I could decide whatever, something that involves many, many pairs, and relations between the pairs. And it could be that it's as difficult at the beginning as at the very end.
But all forms of the second law in statistical mechanics have this feature that you have to choose a coarse graining, and you show that some quantity that you call entropy increases or decreases with respect to that coarse graining. And this is a case like that. And the remarkable thing is that as the system of the n-body system evolves from its deterministic dynamics, a measure of what you could call information or complexity increases. So in that sense, defined with respect to that coarse graining, you could say that the entropy decreases. It's anti-thermodynamic.
In fact, what I'm going to suggest is that there are two entropy type quantities associated with the universe. One which Flavio's coined the expression entaxy, so that we don't confuse it with ordinary entropy. That is scale invariant and it decreases. That reflects the fact that, looked at overall, the universe is becoming less typical as it goes on. It's getting very richly structured. And then the other one is the conventional entropy, which is the entropy of branch systems or subsystems that form. And I hope I can just get on to that in the talk. If not, Flavio and I and Tim are hoping to have a paper out on the archive in about a couple of weeks, something like that. Now, I want to introduce the theory of midpoint better. You look in any book on statistical mechanics and the problem of the arrow of time, they'll say the equations of time reversal invariant, there must have been very special initial conditions. You only have to look at these Janus-type solutions to see that they have got it wrong. The only place where you can sensibly define initial data is at that unique Janus point in the middle, because that's the only place where you haven't got these attractors affecting things, and it's only there that you can specify data truly freely and not be subject to the bias of the attractors, which set in immediately either side. So that's the natural, I would say it's the only sensible place to set midpoint data. So then you have a point and a direction in S determine a solution that starts at that point there. Now, let me just say, crucial here is the difference between a point and a direction. Because if we didn't have that dynamical similarity, because once you're away from D equals zero, there's always a fraction of the kinetic energy in change of size as well as change of shape. The one place where you don't have any kinetic energy in change of size is at the magic Janus point. Now, 5 years ago, I went to Neil to talk about initial data for general relativity, and it was Neil's work. I went with the wrong idea, but Neil came out with the right result. He took just one datum out of the initial value problem for general relativity, which was that in terms of the Newtonian thing, it was a point and a tangent vector. And at that stage, it corresponded to specifying initial data out on that on the slopes of the U, not at the magic point there. But because at that one point there is no scale kinetic energy, at that point, a point and a direction plus the information that the dilatational momentum is zero. So that is scale invariant information, and that is scale invariant information determines a unique solution. And therefore, so this is the projectivized cotangent bundle. It's projectivized because you take out the magnitude of the momenta. And there is this wonderful, I mean, Flavio can tell anybody who's interested, the mathematics of it, which comes out of Arnold's book on dynamics. You have a well-defined measure onto this projectivized cotangent bundle, which is induced from the Liouville measure on the big phase space. And every single point on that projectivized cotangent bundle corresponds uniquely to a solution. So you have a one-to-one mapping onto the solution space. You have total control over every single solution of the theory, including actually the zero measure ones as well. So that's a very important fact, and it's scale invariant. And it only corresponds to the canonical degrees of freedom. You haven't got obstreperous second derivative to worry about as well. So now we come to the theory of typicality of, Sean?
Yeah, I was just wondering, is it fair to say, so if you saw this as like a model for quantum cosmology, the Janus point, would that sort of correspond to the bounce, I guess? If you had like a bounce?
Well, I would, The question is, would this, let us go one step at a time. We do the three-body problem, the n-body problem, then we start thinking about general relativity, and then we start thinking about quantizing it, I would say. Let me go.
I'm a little confused about what you're doing with the large scales.
Sorry, with the what?
I'm confused about your IR cutoff, your longest length scale. Are you assuming it's an infinite space, infinite Euclidean space?
In this model, yes.
And do you assume that it's homogeneous in some sense? Because I could have imagined that there are parts that are locally reach Janus points at different points.
This is the absolute rigorous result in n-body theory with non-negative energy, that there is always, for any n-body solution you choose, with zero angular momentum and zero energy, or positive energy it can be, it's an absolute result of Lagrange and Jacobi that there is just one unique point at which the moment of inertia goes through zero.
Of the whole system.
Hmm?
Of the whole system.
Yes, I'm always talking about the whole system, yes.
Okay. Yeah. You're saying you're only going to be able to define these quantities appropriately if you have non-negative energy? So
now, the negative energy is going to come in. There will not be, you cannot guarantee the existence of a Janus point if the energy is negative. And in fact, in many cases, it won't. It'll go through it many times. But this is going to be very important for the second law of thermodynamics, which I might just get to. Okay. So now, and this is following on from work that Neil did with Gary Gibbons, but back in 1988, Gibbons, Hawking, and Stewart formulated a framework in which to talk about typicality of solutions. How could we guess what would be a typical solution? So the key idea is Laplace's principle of indifference. If I know that there are a certain number of possibilities, but I have no more information about it, and my life depends upon it, here are all the solutions of the three-body problem in a box. I've got to guess typically what they'll look like. I've got to be able to say in advance what they will look like, the typical one. And I'm going to lose my head unless I get the answer right before I pull it out. So in those circumstances, the only rational stance is to give equal probability to everything. So that is called Laplace's principle of indifference. So we know the law, and we want to predict what the typical solutions will be like. And lo and behold, we can do it. Because now this is the image that Shiffrin and Wald, who were actually criticizing this idea of Gibbons, Hawking, and Stewart, their main criticism was because they were working throughout with infinite measures, in which case probabilities are a bit problematic to determine. But the great joy is we have a bounded measure, both on the shape space and on the momentum half as well. So the idea is the creator just throws darts with fins on, so the darts is the point in shape space, and the fins determine the direction. So there's no arrow on it to say I'm going in this direction with this magnitude. It's just the direction is defined, and so the blindfolded creator just throws darts like that. Now I think you'll agree with me if it's random, it's already clear that there's a much larger area where the complexity is low than down in these potential wells.
But
here.
Julian, so yeah? You don't really know what the measure is in this space.
Beg your pardon?
What is the measure in this
space? It's induced from the Liouville measure on the extended phase space.
So you're saying uniform density in phase space tells you...
On the reduced, it's the uniform distribution on the fully reduced phase space.
Where you impose D equals zero.
Where D equals equal to zero, right? That's the thing there. And then you'll already see here in the three-body problem that the great bulk of the things land where the complexity is low, and there's a small probability they'll hit in here, okay? So now let's go on to the next slide. And this is numerical work that Flavio and Tim Koslovsky did, where we, let me go back again, it's really what we want to know is how many solutions are going to be within a certain value of the complexity. Now, the complexity, actually, the longest contour in this one is one that just touches the Euler configurations. It goes round there and comes back there. So this is sort of, there's quite a lot of them there. So these are nicely obtuse triangles, most of them. So you already see there's going to be a preference for triangle shapes, and particularly ones that look like needles, where you just have two particles very close to each other and one very far away. This is down there. They're going to get a very small chance of being chosen. So then we just go on, and now we look and see, you now step into things, what happens throughout statistical mechanics is that uniform distributions, a bit random, these are overwhelmingly more probable than the structured ones. And so if you have n equals 3, this is the fraction, the volume of the reduced, this is only, we're doing this in shape space, this is the volume, the percentage of the volume of shape space, which is plotted against the minimum, the ratio of the minimal value of the complexity, the actual complexity over the minimal. So this is the value where I took those contour lines. And this is what you get for the three-body problem. So already when the complexity has got to 50% more than its absolute minimum at the equilateral triangle, you've already got a pretty good fraction of the things in. But immediately you start increasing the number of particles and you get into sort of statistical things, it peaks very sharply. So what the probability will be in the n-body problem at the Janus point, the vast majority of the solutions will be incredibly uniform, and the velocities will be sort of basically a Gaussian distribution. We might even be able to show that it will be a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So this is very suggestive. And Neil is constantly, this Neil, not that one there, spelled differently. Neil is constantly saying, the universe seems to be incredibly simple on the large scale. And I think this is just suggestive. Maybe that's it there. I just want to say one last bit. Oh, no. Flavio did. Now, there are two in the three-body problem. There are two scale invariant quantities which come out in the asymptotic limit. One is the eccentricity of the Kepler pair, and the other is the angle between its major axis and the direction to the escaping particle. So this is the angle theta. So what Flavio did was numerical calculations where he calculated that value of that theta that comes out asymptotically with various all sorts of solutions where he chose it. And he chose ones where, first of all, the complexity was low, and then ones where the complexity was bigger than that 1.5 value. And then he histogrammed the results he got for that angle. And you see here, there's always a peak up there where it's one. It's aligned. So the major axis is pointing to the escaping particle. But you see here, there's a big hunk of stuff is here. But then when you go to higher initial complexities, you get a quite different histogram. So this says that our theory is perfectly capable of making predictions of what you would find in the asymptotic limit. And if you, in principle, if you had 1,000 particles and you could do the calculations successfully, it would break up into clusters. You would get predictions for the number of Kepler pairs, the number of singletons, the number of three-body systems, and so forth. And I believe that if you put in enough particles, you could get unbelievably strong predictions for what the universe would look like asymptotically, which is where we are, quite a long way from the Big Bang. And lastly, then, once you get these clusters forming, these form what Reichenbach and Paul Davis called branch systems. These branch systems, once these clusters form, they are then trapped in a negative gravitational potential. So the gravitational potential puts them in a box. So they become like Poincaré systems. They will start with some value of their Boltzmann entropy, and then it will grow, basically. So when Clausius in 1865 says the entropy, we add up all the increases of entropy, we see that in all the processes in the world, the entropy of the universe will tend to a maximum. That is true for the entropy of these branch systems. That will be added up. But the reason that that second law of thermodynamics can hold is because of the more fundamental decrease of the scale invariant one, where the entaxy goes in the other direction. So the really fundamental thing is the entaxy goes down from the Janus point, and the Clausius type entropy goes up. And the first, the Entaxy one, is much more fundamental because that's what is reflecting the fact that the dynamical law is causing the universe to cluster and enabling the second law of thermodynamics in its conventional form to set in. And it's nothing whatever to do with a special initial condition. This happens in every solution. All this assumption of Laplace does is enable us to make ever stronger predictions. The behavior will always be of the same qualitative nature. Thanks.
There's time for zero questions, but you have to sacrifice 5 minutes of the coffee break.
Well, the obvious problem is it doesn't include GR, it doesn't include radiation, et cetera, so it's not realistic yet, but I like the picture very much, nevertheless. The one sort of immediate worry is the following, that if you look, for example, at our local cluster of galaxies, the local, whatever it's called, the local cluster, yeah, thing, local group, you can follow the velocities of the galaxies back to the initial t equals zero. And it's not a terrible approximation because basically the gravity of these galaxies, including their halos, did control their recent evolution. Now, if you do this, there's strong evidence that the mass of those galaxies was very uniformly distributed at the Big Bang. Mm. Okay, so Jim Peebles has sort of pioneered this. I think there was an Indian researcher whose name I forgot who started the whole idea off. But basically, you find the stationary point of the action subject to the observations today, for example, at positions, and the assumption that the peculiar velocities of the galaxies was zero initially. And with those two assumptions, you can actually find their trajectories and you can check things are consistent, and it does pretty well. So in the conventional picture, the distribution of mass at the Big Bang was nearly uniform. There seems to be evidence. You could say the evidence from the CMB is. Mm-hmm. But I don't see that in your picture, because basically that's the question, is if you impose this measure, what will you find for the distribution of mass in space around the Janus point? Is it homogeneous?
Oh, to a very high degree, I would say.
Well, that may not be enough.
No, because this
is an extremely high degree. Okay, so the question is whether it really becomes homogeneous. Poisson noise is not good enough. It's got to be more than
that. Can I tell you, there's a very interesting result. Those distributions I showed you for the N-body, by the way, we need to be able to put this in a closed space to be really sure about this thing. Mm-hmm. But when you, I don't know if you know the paper of Batty, Gibbons, and Sutcliffe, where they did numerical calculations of finding the minima and the near minima values of that complexity,
mm-hmm.
unbelievably uniform. They did it up to 10,000 particles. It's super Poissonian. Mm-hmm.
No, but Poisson is not good.
Super Poisson.
Okay, what is the power spectrum? We need to know the power spectrum.
What does super Poissonian mean?
The power spectrum, if you throw Poisson noise, the power spectrum of delta rho will be, how does it go?
It's constant. Poisson is constant, but you want it to go as k, so at a small k should be smaller than Poisson. So it's not Poisson.
Yeah, Poisson is constant, but we actually need it to go like k to the fourth. So usually the argument is that if local dynamics comes in, Zeldovich is k, right?
Yeah, k, yes.
Yeah, sorry. We only need it to go like k. But Poisson is too much power at large k's. You need suppression, like one power of k.
Well, conceivably. I mean, these are technical details. If I can interest people here in these things, we would love to get more technical expertise going on this. By the way, just one remark.
There will be
proper motions on the Janus surface as well, because not every particle will be at rest.
Well, yeah. So then the question is that compatible with the observations? Because the observations are compatible with zero peculiar motions in the initial conditions.
Those are for the galaxies, but the, I mean, my hope, I mean, this is probably Poisson's very naive, but I think getting something which looks a little bit like a thermal Maxwell Boltzmann distribution of the initial data on the general surface. So maybe this is just make, I mean, the wild stream is to make inflation redundant and derive the microwave background from very fundamental first principles. That's Paul, I think you had a question.
I had a different question, which is, if I look at your far future, I have these particles, these massive particles, dust particles, which are interacting with one another. If I imagine I can put that in general relativity and I extrapolate back, haven't I satisfied all the conditions for the Penrose-Hawking singularity theorems? And doesn't that mean, and so how do you escape those?
Well, the hope is that actually the scale part is just a gauge artifact. The one thing, I mean, Roger is now very seriously trying to get his cyclic universe going through, reread his book only a month or so ago. What he wants is actually the conformal geometry on his space-like hypersurface to be reasonably, not wild, but he says it can be a non-vanishing cotton tensor on the three-dimensional.
But he's looking at a very different limit. He's actually looking at a limit that's more like after you've spread your particles way out. So I'm not quite sure what Roger's doing, but I just want to take your system and extrapolate it back, assuming it can fit within GR. Instead of hitting a Janus point, don't you hit a singularity?
No, the singularity would be, as long as the shape degrees of freedom, as long as the conformal geometry remains well-behaved, we can go through that singularity. By the way, exactly the same thing happens in the n-body problem, the three-body problem. People have thought that when you get a total collision, where all things collide on it, that's like a big bang, and you'll find in the n-body, three-body literature, people say that the solution stops there. Now, what they're actually meaning, and I have interacted a lot with n-body people, what they actually mean is that as you approach that point, the solution is extremely sensitive to tiny changes in the initial data. And you'll miss that point unless you get it absolutely spot on. But in fact, if there's one solution that gets you to that triple collision, there's another one that goes out the other side. And in fact, the leading n-body man in Paris said to me, yes, it's just like a pencil balanced on its tip. If it'll fall that way, it can fall that way, and you just go through it. So,
isn't that the opposite of the singularity theorem? One of the singularity theorems was that people originally thought they could miss, but then the singularity theorem showed you couldn't.
Exactly.
It's a strong attractor, if you like.
But I think it's to do with the scale factor. It's the crushing singularity, not necessarily the conformal.
Well, it's true. In classical GR, this is what the Russian school hoped, is that the universe going backwards in time would shrink to a point, the anisotropy would grow, and the universe would somehow miss itself and come out the other side. So that's what they hope for, and then Hawking proved that doesn't happen, you get a singularity. But that's a classical result.
Yeah. By the way, this point, if we're going to get a Janus point, I think we will probably need a positive cosmology. Which may not be the worst of
quantum mechanically, my recent work shows that it bounces. So why worry?
Well,
so it might be that this behavior of Newtonian dynamics classically actually is in very nice agreement with the behavior of GR quantum mechanics.
Well, it could well be, Neil. I'm not very expert at these things. I'm still trying to go with the three in the n-body problem.
Wait for my paper.
Okay, very good.
Let me just say that a cosmological constant is completely useless for this purpose because it's subdominant as you approach the singularity. You're dominated by your matter.
Cosmological constant becomes more and more irrelevant as the universe shrinks.
Can I address Paul's question? Paul, I think you're right, and there's a point here relevant to the point I was making before. There are different versions of shape dynamics in the literature that depend on how one treats the overall volume of space, or the scale factor A. There is a version which is, to my understanding, the experts can correct me, equivalent to general relativity, where the degrees of freedom are the scale-invariant degrees of freedom of the gravitational field, plus one more, which is the scale factor of the volume of the universe. And this, to my understanding, is equivalent to general relativity, and this should satisfy the singularity theorem. There is a different version of shape dynamics in the literature in which one introduces another gauge invariance just to mod out by that last volume of the universe or scale factor. And that, to my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is equivalent to general relativity locally, but differs from general relativity on the scale of the scale factor or the volume of the universe. And that may not behave like a Friedman-Robertson-Walker.
But let's forget about general relativity. Let's just keep common sense, right? If things are colliding, are collapsing onto an arbitrary small point where the energy is going to go to hell. I mean, I don't care what option or what version of shape dynamics you're going to use to shuffle things around. You still have to deal with the singularity.
What we're trying to say is that you need to worry if the anisotropies, those degrees of freedom are singular.
But you're going to have dissipation. You're going to have this.
You have to treat them quantum mechanically. You would worry about worry about the same thing in the hydrogen atom. If somebody told you to inverse minus one over r potential, you'd say, "Oh, it doesn't make any sense."
No, I agree with that. But the
so when you quantize it, there's no problem.
Okay, but this is a classical theory. So if you're going to
classical theory is never going to show the Janus point.
Agree.
Well.
What Q can actually observe in shape space, then they're the same. It's just a different representation of what is objective, which is what.
Then I agree with Neo, and I think we need to have a technical discussion. But the quantum theory, of course, doesn't exist yet. That to get the full benefit out of this Janus point. And something like a bounce, one will need to be talking about the quantum mechanics and not the classical mechanics, when the structure is general relativity and not the end value problem.
Well, I think it's premature to say what will happen.
No, so just going back to this Penrose singularity theorem, if you look at the focusing theorem, what usually happens is you have the expansion scalar, basically, right, contracts. But if you look, let's think about GR and the foliation that is in which it's equivalent to shape dynamics. Then if you think about Eulerian observers, which are those that are in space-time picture orthogonal to that, then the expansion scalar for maximum slicing, for example, cannot contract. It has to stay fixed. So that would be, if you just think about an equivalence of GR, those Eulerian observers would not be able to see a singularity that comes just from the expansion scale.
Right,
have a shear.
Those observers have been essentially frozen.
I'm just trying to translate to space-time picture what in shape dynamics would be a gauge degree of freedom. So in the expansion scalar, if the contraction is in terms of something like a scale factor, then it would be a gauge in shape dynamics. You could still have, that's what I think what they're saying, the anisotropic of it. You could still have some singularities that come from the shear of space-time, for example, but not from the scale factor in a sense. So it's not super clear how the singularity theorems translate if you're thinking about conformal geometrodynamics degree of freedom.
I mean, my point of view on this is that it would be really interesting if we could show in shape dynamics if there's some things that are singular in general relativity that are just gauge in our ontological shift kind of too. But even if we can't, there's still some hope that quantum effects. I mean, it doesn't mean that we can't have. And so, yeah, whether or not the initial singularity is of that nature, we don't know yet, but. Anyways, we're looking into it, but I mean, like I said, I'm not too stressed. Even if we don't find that, I mean, there's still a lot of hope that quantum effects will resolve.
But I'm not even talking about quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Neil?
Yeah.
No. So just to ask a question. So you've talked about shape dynamics and then Newtonian mechanics. It wasn't clear to me what the relationship is between the two of them.
Well, there's a remarkable similarity that if. Certainly, first of all, there is a Janus point in the Big Bang, Big Crunch universe. It's the Gold model. That's at that point of maximum expansion. I don't think that's a good model. You can't do all sorts of problems with redshifts and blue shifts at the crossover point and things like that. So this is why my hope, and I may be naive,
no,
wrong about
I'm
this.
I'm asking a much more simple question.
Oh.
what does shape dynamics got to do with Newtonian
mechanics? Shape dynamics is defined. Give me a shape space.
Yeah.
Shape dynamics is defined as a theory in which either a shape and a tangent vector determines the solution uniquely, or better still, when there's a genus point, a shape and a direction determines the solution uniquely. And in that sense, as viewed in that respect, general relativity and the Newtonian n-body problem are extraordinarily similar. And if there is a Janus point in...
You haven't really told me why I need shape dynamics.
I think,
as a version of GR.
At the risk of stealing the thing, I would say that the space-time picture puts a lot of dung in the Augean stables. The only reality is the shapes. It's one damn shape after another. And if you put in all this extra structure of all the full four things there, it just needs sweeping away so that we can see the truth.
Yeah, but that's rhetoric. So when what has the shape dynamic picture of gravity got to do with the Newtonian n-body problem?
Can I try to answer that?
Yeah.
Same principles, different topology. One is based on fields and the other on particles. But the principles are the same.
The principles
take away scale and...
So have you got a shape dynamics version of... Is that how you describe your n-body work? Is that you're really describing it? I mean, is it a different theory? Have you got a gauge symmetry of the shape dynamic version of Newtonian mechanics?
Locals.
You don't have a local one. Okay, so you haven't really made this analogy very clear.
No, there is a global gauge invariance. In the case when the total energy is zero, there is a global gauge invariance, which means...
A local gauge invariance?
There is a global... When the total energy is zero...
Yeah.
Julian was talking about the case of greater than or equal to zero.
Yeah.
When the total energy is zero, the Newtonian n-body problem can be reformulated in a way that has an additional gauge invariance.
It's not local.
No, it's
not called gauge invariance.
It's a gauge invariance in the technical sense that the dynamics is governed by a Hamiltonian constraint, which is constrained to be zero, and which generates an arbitrary reparameterization of the time.
Yeah.
This is equivalent to Newtonian dynamics, but allows formulation in a different way, especially to the case of energy equal to zero. And that additional gauge invariance essentially implements the philosophy of shape dynamics.
So is that gauge invariance useful in any way?
It led to the entire analysis that Julian showed. The interest in those observables, which are scale invariant observables, which give insight into the n-body Newtonian dynamics, is a consequence of focusing on those scale invariant observables.
That was a global symmetry, not a gauge.
Yeah. No, but
you only needed a global symmetry to
Let me say one variable.
Neil, if you look at the constraint algebra, if you consider that the constraints phase space, the structure is exactly the same. You have a Hamiltonian constraint for the n-body, and you have a dilatational constraint, which is analog to the conformal constraint in shape dynamics.
Yes.
They gauge fix each other, they're second class.
Yes.
And one, a la GHS provides a surface where you can specify midpoint data.
Mm-hmm.
And they both commute with a rotational constraint that generate rotational symmetries and translations.
Mm-hmm.
Those are analog to the diffeomorphism constraint. They are local, they are the global version of those local gauge symmetries. And the fact that these two gauge fix each other allows you to define a GHS type measure, which ends up being finite and allows you to do all of this. And it's also at the basis of all the work by York, Neil here.
I just didn't see why in the Newtonian case the gauge symmetry had to be.
But let me come in with after that beautiful talk on the nerve theorem by Oliver. You can define a gauge theory as being when the Lagrangian, the action, is invariant under a transformation which depends on an arbitrary parameter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an arbitrary function, I think, not an arbitrary parameter. the ones that lead to conserved quantities, it's where it's an arbitrary parameters. If it's an arbitrary function, then you have essentially gauge theory, and you have all the things like Piaget and so on. And the simplest realization of that is the model that Bertotti and I developed in 1980, in which we show that you start where you say only relative separations count, and you have reparametrization of the time variable. And that leads you recover the whole of Newtonian structure, but the extra prediction that the angular momentum of the universe is exactly zero. And it's a little bit harder to argue that the energy must be zero, but you get that. And so the simplest, what I would call the gauge theory in the Noether theorem sense, is actually the Newtonian n-body problem treated in the way Bertotti and I did it. And you see, it's the simplest gauge theory. And that all of this business thinking it's local, that you start with a global thing and then you gauge it, this is a historical accident of the way Weyl discovered it. It's a pure accident of the history. So if you go back to the very simplest gauge theory that you can find is the Machianized, the relational n-body problem.
Okay, I think it's a good point to stop. And I have an announcement for all the participants. Amanda sent an email. She said that she will be here only until 3 something. So if you have something to do with her, you should do it over lunch, reimbursement forms, and all sorts of things like that. So let's thank Julian again.